Okay. I'll just hold it like this. Where's the mic? Yeah, it should do. All right. So today we're gonna continue our series on building a case for the existence of God. This is obviously, we're trying to answer the atheist, a person who doesn't believe in God or believes that there is no God. It's a positive argument. So the past 2 months, we've gone over the cosmological argument, which was showing how the fact that there's a beginning of the universe, so there must be a creator. And then we were able to show how there's different characteristics that we know about the creator based on what we know about the universe. And then last month, we studied the moral argument, which basically showed we know that there are some things that are really good, some things that are really bad. And it seems to be written on our hearts, and we have an obligation to do these things. So there must be, if we have a moral law, there must be a moral law giver. And so we went through that whole argument. Although I think a lot of people were sick, I know, so I haven't sent out the email. I'll send that out along with this one. So those are two arguments so far for the existence of God. And then tonight we're going to study it's called the teleological argument. It's T-E-L-E-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. Teleological. And we know what logical is. It's Logos, it means reason or logic, right? But this teleo part, it comes from a word telos in the Greek, and it basically means an end or a purpose. And so what this teleological argument is going to be looking at, it's going to try to answer the question, what is the purpose of a thing? What is it? What is its end purpose? Or end goal. And so we're going to try to explain or make sense of a thing's purpose or design. And that's why this teleological argument is also called the design argument. Now, when I say design, right? Or rather, before I get to that part, we're going to look at certain features of the universe that look like they've been designed right, and they cry out for a designer. So we're going to hopefully show some good reasons as to why we believe there's a designer. And as a Christian, obviously this is important, because Christianity at the very outset, right, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And then in Psalm 19, I believe, where the psalmist wrote, the heavens declare the glory of God. So when you look up into the stars and in space, it's just like, wow. And imagine being back then, back in the time when the psalmist wrote, where there was no light pollution or anything like that, and you could just see everything. Imagine looking into that sky. And so heavens declare the glory of God, that vast expanse. And then in Romans 1, Paul mentions that through the creation, we can see the Creator, so that no one has an excuse, because creation points to a Creator. And immediately when you hear the word design or designer or the design argument, stuff like this, we're probably thinking about evolution, you know, design versus evolution, Darwinism, stuff like that, monkeys to man or something like that. And yeah, that is a popular battleground. That's a popular argument to go through. And there was a recent debate that took place, Ken Ham versus Bill Nye. I'm not sure how many of you saw that. And that was really more centered on evolution versus creationism, right? And so that's one aspect. And despite its popularity, it's also very emotionally charged. People get very up in arms especially this day and age, it's always evolution versus God, and take intelligent design out of the schools, and no, we want to show the entire positive arguments for Darwinism as well as the deficiencies, but you know, certain people don't want to allow the deficiencies to be taught, stuff like that. It's very emotionally charged. Well, this design argument that we're going to study tonight, the teleological, it kind of does an end run around the whole evolution aspect. So we're not going to touch on evolution today. Rather, what this argument's going to do, and it's pretty nifty, is that it's going to take the argument a step further. So it's going to say, even before we worry about evolution, we have to ask the question, why is this universe, why does it support life at all? So even, because evolution doesn't answer the question about how life originated. So that comes after creation. So the design argument is saying, why does the universe seem like it's set up to support life? In other words, it seems that the universe's purpose for existence is to support life. And so that's why we're going to study. And I think it's going to be a little bit more efficient, you know, when you go and witness to people on the street and they'll be wanting to talk about the evolution. You can tell them, no, let's take it a step further. Let's talk about the universe. It seems to be set up for life. What's the best explanation there? And another benefit of using this design argument is that you avoid the emotions, right? It's going to be short and easy to understand, easy to memorize. So you can use it. You don't have to memorize a whole bunch of evolutionary facts and, you know, both sides of the argument, stuff like that. This one's very short, easy to memorize. There's not too much information, right, compared to evolution. And now you put the skeptics on their heels. Because now they must explain why the universe is even able to support life in the first place. So they probably know a whole lot about evolution, but I guarantee you they probably don't know as much about the parameters of the universe and stuff like that. So those are some benefits. And then and benefit for the Christian personally is that usually I know I've heard a lot of people try to use this kind of as a stump question to ask the skeptic, like, well, where do you think all this came from? And then usually we stop there. We don't really have anything to say after. We just kind of hope that they'll chew on that question and then be like, oh yeah. But from an apologetic standpoint, I don't really think that gets the job done. You want to be able to ask the question, and then when they're thinking about it, you can then go ahead and support it with evidence. So you ask, where did all this come from? And be like, I don't know, it just happened. And then you can go and talk about, well, let's see if that's actually possible. You can give them evidence. Okay. So even though we're not going to talk about evolution today, I think next month we'll touch on some of the Darwinian evolution aspects and show how it's actually not a good possibility. So without further ado, why don't we get into the argument? And just like the other arguments, this is in the form of a syllogism. So there's two premises, and then we have our conclusion. And the first premise, it's going to be a little long, so just, I guess, try to write shorthand. But the first premise, it says this: the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. I'll repeat it. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. And we'll explain what those three mean. The second premise is, it is not due to physical necessity or chance. It is not due to physical necessity or chance. And then the conclusion is, therefore, it is due to design. Therefore, it is due to design. So this is, last month we had a different kind of syllogism. That was like a modus tollens This one's a disjunctive, so you have or kind of setup. And but it's still a deductive argument. And the benefit of having an argument in the form of a deductive argument is that the conclusion necessarily follows from the premises. So if you can show that those two premises are true or more plausible, then the conclusion is guaranteed. It has to follow. So it provides a level of certainty whenever you can provide good evidence for those premises. Now, of course, we can't just say the argument, right? We have to provide good reasons, and that's what this class is all about. So that's what we're hoping to do right now. Now, before we start looking at our first premise to see if those are true or not, I want to talk about why the issue is significant in the first. Why is this important to begin with? Why are we, as Christians, looking to support the idea of a designer? Well, I'll let you know that even in the times of Plato and Aristotle, so these guys were before even Jesus was on the scene, right? So this is Old Testament times. Even in their time, these were philosophers, and they did believe that when you just looked out into the starry skies, that it was evidence of a designer. That was enough for them, just to look out and see the complexity and the vastness, and they said there has to be a designer for all this, right? Well, I guess in today's day and age, and maybe in the past couple of hundred years, it's been popular to just say that, you know, given enough time and luck, randomness, it was bound that the universe should evolve life somehow. So that's what the current popular argument is, that just give me enough time, give me a little bit of luck, and life's going to pop up somewhere. It has to. By chance, basically. Well, in the last 40 or 50 years, there's been a lot of knowledge increase, especially in the area of astronomy. So in physics, astronomy, these guys have their huge telescopes, and they're looking out into the stars, and they're doing their physics equations, and they're trying to find out as much as they can. In the last 40 or 50 years, they've found out quite a good amount of information to show that, wow, the universe is much more complex than we initially thought. There's a lot of complexity, and it's getting a little uncomfortable, all right? And we'll read into some of that right now. Well, now with this knowledge in place, the question of design is becoming more serious. And so now we have something like this design argument being formed, and it's gaining popularity. It's starting to become more powerful. Now, you notice that I mentioned the word fine-tuning. Now, I want to explain what I mean by fine-tuning, or what scientists and physicists mean when they say fine-tuning of the universe. So a definition of fine-tuning would be, it means to say that there's certain constants and certain quantities in the universe whose values fall into an extraordinarily narrow range of for the universe to be life permitting. I'll say it again. There's certain constants and quantities in the universe that have a very narrow range of values that they can possibly have in order for the universe to be life permitting. Okay? And when I say narrow, I'm talking very, very narrow. It's been said that that these values are balanced on a razor's edge. So you think of a razor and how thin it is, a very sharp one. And then, you know, imagine trying to balance on that. These values are so narrow, or the ranges are so narrow, that they have to balance on a razor's edge. And we'll see that even a razor's edge is too much. It's too much area. We're talking about subatomic. That's how crazy fine-tuned it is. Now, one thing to be aware of is that if you were to be in a conversation and tell a person, hey, well, I think that the fine-tuning of the universe is a good argument for existence of God. And they might tell you, well, you say fine-tuning, and I just know that you mean designed. Because fine-tuning, you know, you think of those of you who work on cars or something, or mechanics or something like that. When you say fine-tuning, you kind of picture messing with stuff. And so it already brings the idea of designed, right? But that's not what we mean when we say fine-tuning here in the argument. So it's not like a circular argument. I'm not just trying to define God into existence. When we say fine-tuning, it's all we simply mean that the values that these constants fall into, that they're just narrow, that they have very little wiggle room. That's all we're saying. And everybody can agree with that. Scientists agree with this. It's well established. Fine-tuning is well established in the scientific realm. So they know that these values have very little wiggle room. That's all we're saying. We're not saying it's designed. But we are asking the question, what is the best explanation for the fine-tuning? Okay? And then it's also helpful to know that there's two kinds of fine-tuning. Two kinds. One of them has to deal with constants of the universe, and we'll talk about it right now. And then the other has to do with arbitrary quantities of the universe. Arbitrary basically means it's not random, but it's just without restriction. For instance, if I arbitrarily choose to eat while I study, it means that it was just my preference, my discretion. So it wasn't random. I may have a reason, but it's up to me. So it's left to one's judgment or one's discretion. That's all it means. So let's talk about the constants. What do we mean when we say constants of the universe are fine-tuned? Well, it seems to me that when we look at certain laws of nature, and there's kind of like these fundamental laws of nature that universe just abides by, like gravity, and we're going to bring it up. When we express these laws of nature as mathematical equations, we see that there's certain numbers in the equation that never change. And that's what constant means, right? Is that there's certain numbers in the equation that are unchanging. No matter what other values you put in there, that one always stays the same. And it's needed for that law of nature to work. And it's weird. So, for instance, we're talking about gravity. Well, gravity, the force of gravity, the equation is basically the gravitational constant. And then you multiply the masses of two masses or two objects. And then you divide that by the distance between them and you square that distance. You don't have to know the equation, but I just want to point out there's a gravitational constant there. And I have the number in here, but we don't have to go through that. But I want to point out that it's not governed by the law of nature. For instance, when the universe is created, it's not like that number had to be that certain value that it has. So it's independent of the laws of nature. Okay? For instance, there could be a universe that existed that had a different value for that constant. And there could have been a different universe that resulted as a result, right? I'm just trying to show that that number didn't have to be that value. Okay, it's not necessary. Now I have to ask the question is, why does it have that value that it has today? Why are we in the universe that has that value? And that's one question we're going to answer. So that's constants. There's certain equations in the universe that have certain unchanging values. And it's weird, you know, in order for the universe to work, they're just there. So the next one is these arbitrary quantities. Now, these values are, in physics at least, they're seen as just initial conditions put into the universe. So whenever the universe was created, there was certain initial conditions that were just kind of put there. And one of them is the amount of entropy. And we talked about this in the cosmological. The amount of entropy is just the amount of disorder, right? So it's kind of like, oh, okay, here's the mass. You know, it's just this amount of disorder. And then the laws of nature come in. And then the universe is able to expand at that point and just it's free to do whatever it wants. And it's free to create a certain kind of universe. But you have these initial conditions, right? So these initial starting points, and then the laws of nature come in and act on these certain values, and then the universe just goes from there, and a certain kind of universe is born. Okay, but these are just arbitrary. You have to ask yourself, why do they have these values? Why couldn't they have this other value? What if there's only one universe, right? Why did they have to have these values? And we're going to answer that question based on our first premise, right? We have three options. So now that we know what fine-tuning is, and then what fine-tuning deals with, the constants and the quantities, let's move on to examples of fine-tuning. So where do we see fine-tuning in the universe? And before I get to an example, I just want to show you how narrow the range we're talking about, okay? And let's see about this. It's been estimated that the number of subatomic particles in the entire known universe. So subatomic particles means smaller than an atom, right? We know atoms are made from electrons, protons, neutrons, and then even smaller than those are like quarks and bosons and all these other things, right? So those, the amount of all those in the entire known universe is estimated to be somewhere in like 10 to the 80th power. That means that you have the number one followed by 80 zeros. That's what that means. So you have 180 zeros amount of subatomic particles in the entire known universe. That's an unfathomable large amount. I can't even comprehend 10 to the 80th. Now, when we look at the debt for the U.S., right, we're talking about the trillions. That's what? 10 to the 9th is billion, right? 10 to the 12th would be trillion. So imagine 10 to the 80th. You have that many more zeros on the other side of the one. That's just a humongous amount, okay? So I just want to give you that. So when I say to the 80th power or some other power, just tack on that many zeros. So now let's get to our first example of fine-tuning. It's known as one of the fundamental laws of nature is the weak force. The weak force is, I believe this is what governs decay in atoms. But that's neither here nor there. But it's been found that if you change this value, I don't have it written here what the value is, but if you were to change this value on the order of one part out of 10 to the 100th power, it would prevent a life-permitting universe from forming. And I'll explain it. So the weak force. The weak force, if you're changing one part out of 10 to the 100th power, and what this means, when this expression, what it means is that you have the number one this time, and then before the number one, you have 100 zeros, and then you have a decimal point. And we're talking about percentages here. So imagine 0.00000000000. 100 zeros, and then the number 1%. If you were to change just that very, 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 very tiny amount of the weak force value, you would not have a universe that permits life. So 0.00001%. If you were to just change that from the weak force, no life. I mean, that is super, super narrow. It's incomprehensible almost, okay? And now let's talk about the cosmological constant. This constant is what governs the expansion of the universe. So that we talked about in the last argument, the cosmological argument, how we evidence for the expansion of the universe. It's growing and growing, always expanding. Well, if we were to change this value on the order of one part out of 10 to the 120th power, so 0.00120 zeros and then a 1%. If you were to change that value by that very, very tiny amount, you wouldn't have life. It's ridiculous. And then lastly, this one gets even insane, is the low entropy initial condition. So the amount of disorder at the beginning of the universe, or at the formation of the universe. It's said that the odds of this amount of low entropy at the beginning of the universe, the odds of that existing by chance alone is on the order of one chance out of 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power. So, first of all, you take 10 to the 123rd power, and then you take 10 to that ridiculous amount. And so you have that. I don't even know how many zeros that is, honestly. But so you have 10 to... Oh, man, I couldn't even fathom it. 10 to the 123rd. You have 1 and 123 zeros after it. So you take 10 to the 1 and 123 zeros after it. That's not even in the ballpark. It's been said that the maximum probability that you can safely say that an event will not occur is like 10 to the 125th power or something like that. So if something has a range of or probability of that amount, it's, you're safe to say it's not going to happen. So imagine 10 to the 1 followed by 123 zeros. That's ridiculous. Like, come on. And so that's those are the odds of just having the low entropy, the disorder at the beginning of the universe. And scientists, this is well established. Every scientist would agree with this, okay? So we're not saying anything controversial or unknown. They know about this. They know the universe is fine-tuned. But now the question becomes, what is the best explanation for this? So now we can look at our first premises, okay? The first premise is the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. And remember, we have to show good evidence that each premise is true. And so for this first premise, it's really non-controversial. This first premise, all it's doing is giving you your options. So it really doesn't need much evidence. In fact, no, I don't think really anybody would disagree that these are the only three options. If anybody can think of a fourth, so if you're out talking to somebody and they, oh, what about this? It might fall under some of these three categories, but it just has a different name. Or if it's truly a fourth category, which I don't think it will be. But yeah, throw it on in and ask them, what evidence do you have? You know? So this first premise really doesn't need any explanation. It's just giving us our options, and I think those are the three options: physical necessity, chance, and design. Now I want to explain real quick what each of them means. Physical necessity. It means that those quantities and the constants, that they must have the values that they do, that it's physically impossible for them to have any other value somehow. That's all it means. So there's no other way that for them, these values to be different. And then chance, when somebody says chance, they're basically saying that these values are the way they are purely by accident. Okay? Just by accident that these values kind of just got there. And then designed, of course, means that there was an intelligence behind it. You know, engineers design buildings, design cars, stuff like that. So there's an intelligence behind design. That's what that means. Again, it's unobjectionable. So then now that we know that, we know that all we have to do is support premise two. So if we can show that premise two is true, then our conclusion necessarily follows. And let's look at premise two again. It says, it is not due. The fine-tuning is not due to physical necessity or chance. So we're basically trying to eliminate two of those options. And then when we do that, if we can do that, we're just left with one, which is the winner by default, because it's the only option left. So it's kind of cool where you don't really have to support design if we're right here. We don't really have to give much evidence. It's just kind of like, yeah, these other two, they don't do a good job. Therefore, design is the best explanation that we have so far. Okay? So that's what's cool, is that we don't really have to give a lot of evidence. We just have to show that these two guys don't do the job. And that's what we're going to do right now. Let's look at physical necessity first. So again, I'll repeat that it's physical necessity is saying that it's physically impossible for life not to come about. It had to happen. These values had to have those values. How do we respond to this claim? It seems kind of hard. Well, remember what we just studied, right? These constants and these arbitrary quantities, and how they're not dependent on the laws of nature, right? We could imagine these constants having different values and different universes forming as a result. They didn't have to be that way. They're not dependent on the laws of nature. So I can always ask, well, why does the gravitational constant have the value it does out of all the possible values that it can have? So there's a range. Why did it have to have that value? So it seems to me that it didn't have to have that value. Therefore, it's not physically necessary. Okay? So, in fact, somebody who holds this view of physical necessity, they're taking a very radical stance. I don't think any scientist really worth their degree would say physical necessity, because that's very, very hard to prove, very, very hard to back up. They understand that these values have a range, and it could have been anywhere in there. It didn't have to have that one value. And so it seems to me that physical necessity, as being one of the options, it's just there kind of just to mention all the possibilities. We don't want to miss one, so we just have to put it there. But it's not really important. You know, nobody really holds that unless you're out there, right? So I think we can cross this one off the list. We can show these constants and these quantities, they can have different values. They're not necessary. So physical necessity, I think, is we can show right away. It's not a really valid alternative. So now then, we have to move on to the next. Now the crucial one is chance. Okay? In this one, again, it says that life just happened by accident. That these constants and quantities had the values just kind of out of dumb luck. All right? Well, we have to ask, well, could this really be the case? Ask the person you're dialoguing with. If they say, well, chance and time, or just luck. We're just lucky that the universe turned out this way. You want to ask them, put them on their heels and have them defend it. Well, tell me how. How could this be the case, that chance? Does chance really work out? And whenever they give you a response, hopefully we can be armed with some information, and we'll go through that right now. One response would be is that the fundamental problem with chance is that the chances of a life-permitting universe existing is so astronomically low that it's unreasonable to even think that chance could play a part. Remember, we're talking about with the values we just talked about, the 10 to the 10 to the 123rd. I mean, seriously, you have to ask yourself at some point, at what improbability can I support? You know, where's the line that I'm going to draw that I'm going to say, you know what, that's just too improbable for chance to do it alone. Therefore, I'm not going to believe in chance. You know, where do you draw the line? And hopefully you can show these numbers to the skeptic and show, look, these are the numbers. Now, would you play the lottery if you had, I mean, a lot of us don't play the lottery because we know the odds. And those odds of the lottery are super, super much more probable that we win the lottery than these values having, or these constants having these values. And so you can show them that. if you wouldn't even play the lottery based on the odds that we have now, what do you think about these constants? Where are you going to draw the line? Or are you just going to blindly follow just in order to avoid design? So you kind of challenge them that way. So again, the probability of a life-permitting universe existing by chance alone, it's just too low. You know, you don't want to bet your money on that at all. Well, the skeptic might raise an objection. They'll say, in order to justify chance, they'll say, you know what? In reality, it's meaningless to talk about probabilities. Because after all, only one universe exists, right? We're in it. It doesn't make sense to talk about one out of every 10 universes is life permitting, right? If you change the ranges, it's dumb to talk about probabilities. Well, an illustration might help at this point. So you could take out a sheet of paper and just put like a little red dot on it. And that'll represent a life permitting universe, right? One like ours. And then you can ask them, well, let's change the quantities and the constants a bit. And when we do that, if it winds up being a life-permitting universe, we draw another little red dot on the paper. And if it's not a life-permitting universe, draw a blue dot. And then you repeat this process over and over until you fill the whole sheet up with dots. And what you'll find is that paper will probably be blue. And very, 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 very tiny amount of red dots. Because that's how improbable a life-permitting universe to exist is. That's how vastly improbable it is for a life-permitting universe to exist. And so you can show them right there that when you draw a dot, it's not that we're saying that there's 10 universes and then one of them is life-permitting. We're just using it as a description, right? When we talk about statistics, and we're not saying that these things actually exist. We're just saying that these are descriptions. They're just odds, right? Statistics. So you can tell them, well, it is meaningful to talk about probabilities, right? Because if we just change these values, we're just describing what could have been. We're not describing what actually is. All right. So that's the first objection they may bring up. Another one that the skeptic might bring up is that he might appeal to a lottery in this point. He's saying, in order to justify chance, remember? He'll say, well, think of it as a lottery where all the tickets have been purchased. So think about, let's say everyone in the United States buys a ticket, right? 300 million people, let's say. Everyone buys a ticket. Now, my odds are still 1 out of 300 million, which is really low, right? So I'm not very confident in my odds. But the skeptic will say, somebody has to win. Because all the tickets have been purchased. So somebody has to win. And so they'll say the same thing about the universe. One of these values had to be chosen. And it just so happened that it's a life-permitting universe. And that seems kind of, oh, you know what, you're right. We just got lucky. You know, these values, yeah, they had to be chosen. And we just got lucky. Well, it seems clever, but unfortunately, it's based on a misunderstanding of the design argument. You see, we're not trying to explain why this particular universe that we're in, we're not just trying to explain this particular universe. We're trying to explain a life-permitting universe in general. Remember, those ranges, even though they're very, very small, they can still change a bit for them to permit life. So we're just talking about life-permitting universes in general. And you could probably correct the skeptic at this point and bring a better analogy into play. And have them think about it like this. Envision, you know, like those big domes or like a bingo cage, you know, like that. And tell them, imagine that bingo cage or whatever is filled up with billions and billions and billions of white ping pong balls. And then there's one black one. Now, let's say you're told to pick one random, you know, you do this and one of them rolls down. Let's say you're told to do that. If it's white, you're going to get shot. If it's black, you get to live. Now tell them, at that point, the improbability of any one of those balls being chosen is the same. One out of billions and billions and billions. Each ball has the same improbability. That's where the similarity between the two analogies and the lottery, that's where it ends. So what the design argument is trying to show is that even though these ping pong balls have the same improbability, it's more improbable that you would get the black one, the life-permitting one, rather than the white. That's what you're trying to show. Is that, yes, even though these values are equally improbable, any one of them has to be chosen, we're just trying to show that it's vastly more improbable that the life-permitting one is going to be chosen. I mean, and to drive the point home, tell them that these odds of billions and billions and billions, yeah, you could get lucky maybe, but let's ask them, what if you had to choose or find the black ball 5 times in a row? That's getting a little bit more realistic. So if you were to get 5 black ping pong balls in a row, then you would start thinking, you know what? I think this whole bingo thing or whatever has been rigged. I think we would be justified in thinking that. That's the kind of odds we're talking about, okay? All right. Another objection, this last objection that the skeptic could bring up, and this is actually gaining popularity in today's scientific realm, is it's gotten so bad that physicists and astronomers have brought up this hypothesis called the multiverse, or the many worlds hypothesis. So the reason this is because they understand that chance alone really doesn't cut it. You know, they understand the kind of narrow possibilities of life-permitting ranges. And so they said, well, you know what? What if there's a world ensemble? What if there's just a ton of other universes that actually exist, and they preferably want an infinite amount? But remember what we talked about, infinity not being a real thing? So they really want an infinite amount so that way they can have all the values and different combinations of values. And they say, well, if it's true that an infinite amount of universes actually exist, then we shouldn't be surprised that one life-permitting universe exists. Because there's an infinite amount. Every single possibility is out there, and we just happen to be one of them, and it's life-permitting. And this is a serious hypothesis being put forth by scientists. Well, how do we respond to this? Is this a plausible theory? Okay. I've seen this actually being played out in debates. It's a little scary, but it's silly also. So let's talk about how can we respond. Well, first of all, it seems to me that the multiverse itself has to be fine-tuned. So think about it this way. In order for there to be a ton of universes, they all had to have beginnings. They're not infinite. In the past, they were not eternal. They have to have beginnings. So you have to ask yourself, what is the mechanism that's generating these universes? And it seems to me that if you're going to generate a universe, you got to be finely tuned yourself, right? You're not just going to randomly throw a bunch of constants and quantities together and think you're going to have a universe. It seems to me that whatever these scientists believe is generating these universes has to be finely tuned. So it's not really answering, or it's not really taking down the design argument. It's just pushing it back one step. Oh yeah, you want to do multiverse? What's generating it? It seems like that has to be fine tuned. And then another thing you can ask them is, well, okay, you believe in the multiverse. Where's the evidence? That I think that really is the kicker there. Because remember, when you're talking to an atheist, at least atheists these days, they're really big on evidence, scientific evidence, right? They're all about show me the evidence. Because especially if you talk to like a really aggressive atheist, they're gonna be quick to show how the Christian relies on faith. And they typically mean that faith is just blind trust. You know, faith is believing in something that you know is not true. That's what they think it means. And so they believe that we think, or that we believe in things that we don't have any evidence for. So they're big on evidence. And so you can ask them, oh, you believe in the multiverse? What evidence do you have? And I guarantee you, they're not going to have any. It is literally just an invention right now. And it might work on paper to an extent, but there is not a shred of physical evidence for the multiverse. And so it seems to me that in reality, the multiverse hypothesis is actually a backhanded compliment to the design argument. I mean, think about it. The fact that you have to go that far to speculate about an infinite number of universes just to avoid design as an answer, it shows that the design argument is pretty powerful. That you have to go to these great lengths to believe in something that you don't have a shred of evidence for in order to just avoid design. So these are pretty strong objections that you can raise to the atheist or skeptic. Where's the evidence? Show me the evidence for this multiverse. All right. Well, I think at that point we can say physical necessity is out, right? That was an easy one. Chance, we said the chances of chance working is just so astronomically low. It's unreasonable to hold that position. And we saw objections that skeptics may rise that really, they don't cut it. They're easily dealt with. So it seems to me that we can also X out chance as one of the alternatives. So then once we do that, I think we've shown premise two to be true. It is not due to physical necessity or chance. So then that leaves us then with design. Design's left. Now, just for good measure, what can we say about design? Is it plausible? Is it implausible? Well, I did want to bring up an argument that's been brought up by a popular atheist in Britain. His name is Richard Dawkins. And I would say that a lot of atheists these days, at least ones that really don't, they're just angry atheists, really. They know about Richard Dawkins, and they can quote him and stuff like that. So Richard Dawkins wrote a book called The God Delusion. And in that book, he tried to write like a knockdown argument for the existence of God. And it had to do with design. And this is the way it goes. One of the greatest challenges to the human intellect has been to explain how the complex, improbable appearance of design in the universe arises. Atheists, biologists, chemists, physicists, scientists, even though they're atheists, they do see the apparent design in nature. It's just that they would say it's not real design. So that's why he says this. One of the greatest challenges is to explain how this complex, improbable appearance of design in the universe arises. And then he goes on to say, premise two, the natural temptation is to attribute the appearance of design to actual design itself. Premise three, the temptation is a false one because the designer hypothesis immediately raises the larger problem of who designed the designer. Premise four, the most ingenious and powerful explanation is Darwinian evolution by natural selection. Premise five, we don't have an equivalent explanation for physics, just biology, right? Evolution. Premise six, we should not give up the hope of a better explanation arising in physics, something as powerful as Darwinism is for biology. Premise seven, which is the conclusion, therefore, God almost certainly does not exist. So it's kind of a long argument, but I'll just tell you this right now. It's an invalid argument. Do you guys remember what an invalid argument is? So there were steps to creating a a good argument. One of them is that it has to be valid, first of all. Meaning that just has to deal with the structure of your argument. Meaning that, so the conclusion has to follow from the premises. So it has to be set up correctly. That's all it is. And then the other requirement of a good argument is that your premises have to be true. So that way you know you're not just, blowing smoke. That you're not just talking nonsense. Well, Richard Dawkins, he's a good writer. He's a good scientist. But he's a bad, bad logician and philosopher. This argument is completely invalid. It's not even set up correctly. The conclusion, which is therefore God almost certainly does not exist, it does not in any way follow from these premises that he had. Yeah, it really just is tacked on at the end. It does not follow. And this is his knockdown argument, apparently. And he makes this elementary logical mistake. And he's done it over and over. You see him in interviews and debates and stuff. So this is an invalid argument. Now, you know, just to give him some sort of pat on the back, we can look at his individual premises and see how they fare. And I got to say, he even has false premises. So even if it were valid, his premises aren't even true. So even it still wouldn't be a good argument. For instance, step number 5, when he says, we don't have an equivalent explanation for physics along with step 6, we should not give up the hope for a better explanation, like evolution for physics or something like that. That's a logical fallacy. He's basically appealing to the future. Oh, just wait. I'm going to have the evidence soon. I don't have it yet, but I'm going to have it soon. But yet, they tell the Christian or the believer in God that, well, you guys have the God of the gaps. Anything that you don't know, you just say God did it. Well, that's the same thing that you're doing. You're just saying you're going to have it in the future. How can you be so sure? And then step number 3, when he says the temptation is a false one because the designer hypothesis immediately raises the larger problem of who designed the designer. And you're going to hear this a lot. You're going to hear this a lot. So they might be a little challenged, meaning that they're going to be challenged in their beliefs. And they might be like, oh, you know what? This seems like a strong argument. It does seem to point to a designer. But then as a last-ditch effort, they'll ask, well, I'm not ready to accept your conclusion because there's still this nagging question. Who designed God? Who designed the designer? Now, at first glance, this might seem like a strong objection, but it's really not. For instance, think of an archaeologist. They're digging around, you know, brushing fossils off and stuff like that. And let's say they come to this campsite, an ancient campsite, and they find an arrowhead. And then they also find pottery shards. Now, immediately in the archaeologist's mind, they know people have been here. This arrowhead was made by a person. Now, it doesn't make sense for them, like, oh, I can't really sign off on that was made by a person unless I know who these people were. Unless I have an explanation of the designer of these things, I can't sign off. No. No archaeologist does that. They know that even though they don't know anything about the people who created this stuff, you can still tell that it was designed. It was created. And same thing with the design hypothesis. You don't have to have an explanation of the designer in order to know that something is designed in the first place.
Wouldn't it also just kind of be self-defeating? If they're saying, well, who designed the designer? They're saying, I mean, wouldn't they also wonder who designed them? If they're that curious about who designed the designer?
Yep, that's that. Right.
But they'll use that as an argument.
It leads to an infinite regress.
Correct.
You could never have a beginning point. Right. And so if that were the case, you wouldn't be able to do science. you would never be able to come to a final conclusion.
Because there'd be no starting
point. There'd be no starting point. And so I don't think they really understand that when they say that, but hopefully you can point that out to them, right? Hey, you're going to lead to an infinite regress and bring up the archaeologist example, stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, his premises aren't even true. So it seems to me, guys, in the end that just the inherent improbabilities, just those few examples of fine-tuning that we brought up, and there's, I believe there's over 60 constants and quantities that scientists know presently that have these extraordinarily fine-tuning values to them. 60. All right? And so it seems to me that just the inherent improbabilities of those having those values, it gives an edge to design over chance and physical necessity, right? Because that one was easy. But I want to, just to end it, I want to give you an illustration just to kind of hammer this point home. Consider a self-enclosed, like, dome. Let's say we have inhabited Mars and we're living under a dome, right? A biosphere or something like that. And you get there and you go to the control room. And in the control room, you see, let's say, you see all these 60 dials, 60 plus dials. You know, there has to be enough heat, there has to be enough moisture, oxygen, all this stuff in order for life to be flourishing or permitted inside the biosphere. And you see that these dials are, man, they're so precisely tuned. They're precisely set to their position. Very, very precise. Each and every single one of them, you're like, you know, I don't even want to breathe. Now, in your head, what would you automatically think? That chance just set these dials? That they kind of just built it and now they'll get to the precise positions? Or that a scientist spent a good amount of time thinking about this very thoroughly and set those dials such that life would be permitted? It seems to me that it screams for a designer. That's the way to think about it. These dials have to be set so precisely. So that's a good, I think that'd be a good illustration to share with a skeptic if they ever just say, well, I just think that luck, that chance brought us here. Well, you really sure? Let's go through the probabilities of some of these values of the universe. So that's the design argument, guys, or at least one form of it, dealing with the fine-tuning of the universe.